Judge Gaitas, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Larson, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning, everyone. You may be seated. And we are now resuming our calendar this October 20th of 2022 with the fourth case scheduled for oral argument in the matter of the Otto Bremer Trust, A220906. And it's my understanding that counsel are ready to proceed with the arguments. As you know, appellant will have 15 minutes to present, then respondent will have 15 minutes to present, and appellant, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal, regardless of how much time you use during your principal argument. I just ask that you please introduce yourselves before you begin your arguments and identify the party you're representing, because we're making an audio recording of the arguments today. And during that time, let us know if there is any other identifying information that you would like us to know to make you more comfortable when we address you this morning. And with that, we are ready to begin with counsel for appellant.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Andrew Parker, representing the appellant. With me here today is Reginald Snell from our office, and Mr. Lipschultz is here today as well. Your Honors, at the core of this case is the application of an erroneous legal standard to find removal of trustee Brian Lipschultz. In fact, it is a legal standard that is made up out of whole cloth. Despite the fact that the court made findings of 102 pages, about 98 of them all rejecting any sense of removal under any standard that the legislature has enacted or that follows from the trust instrument, the court nonetheless created a new standard here in Minnesota, and that is conduct that has no place in the charitable world standard. And that standard should not be applied. It has not been legislatively enacted, and it is a dangerous standard, really, in terms of trusts and charitable trusts, because it would allow for the removal simply based on a judge's own predilections without respect to the settlor's intent, the trust instrument, or legislative enactments.
Let me stop you just for a minute. I want to make sure, because I'm not sure I read the district court's orders the same way you're presenting it. First off, you're not challenging any of the findings of fact per se.
That's correct.
Clearly erroneous. All right. So and so then I'm, you know, turning to the conclusions of law. I mean, I see the district court, I guess at page 99 of the state's addendum, gets into the heart of the breaches by your client that supports the district court's determination that he should be removed. I mean, the district court cites the applicable statute, so why should we conclude that he, in fact, didn't rely on the law as expressed in the statute as terms of deciding based on all the evidence that a removal of your client was appropriate? Why should we assume the district court didn't follow the law?
Well, first, Your Honor, simply by citing the statutes, which the court did, does not mean that the findings that the court made can in any way meet those legal standards. And in fact, that is our argument. It is an abuse of discretion based on the findings the court themselves made to determine that removal is appropriate under the legal standards. The court cited 501C.0706B1. And this is and one is a serious breach of trust. That has been interpreted by the courts to mean a breach that causes significant harm to the trust or involves flagrant misconduct. And the findings in this case simply don't meet up with that. The findings in this case amount to a de minimis use of trust assets that was completely admitted by Mr. Lipschultz. It was a good faith mistake that he made. It never happened again. There was no reoccurrence, and the court itself found it was de minimis and that removal
Well, I think the court found the amount was de minimis, the amount of money involved for the years that it was, you know, tracked and paid back, given the extent of the assets held by the trust. But, I mean, the court did said this was a breach of trust.
And no question, a breach of trust, but not a removable act. In fact, the court said that. In and of itself, this would not be a basis for removal. So then you look at what were the foundational elements that the court based it on, and do those meet the legal standards of harm to the trust, flagrant misconduct, which is a serious breach of trust. And they simply don't, and they can't. And it's an abuse of discretion to find that they do.
The district court seemed particularly concerned about the events regarding junior achievements and the CEO. Yeah, more concerned about that incident or series of incidents than I think anything else, at least based on my reading of the order. How is that not flagrant?
What occurred as it relates to junior achievement doesn't meet the legal standards, because what you have is one incident involving a grantee out of maybe 8,000 or 9,000 over the years that has ever come up related to this trustee or any other trustee. One incident. And what occurred in that incident? As found by the court themselves, what occurred there was in the midst of a war to save the trust. That's what this was. It was nothing short of a war to save the trust, with the bank, with the help of the Attorney General's office, standing in the way of the trust potentially being able to make its distributions because dividends would not be paid properly by the bank. The court themselves found the danger that the trust was in. So in the midst of this war, Mr. Lipschultz attempts to garner support from a grantor, from Junior Achievement. Now, maybe he did it in a way that has no place in the charitable world, or this judge was offended by, but is that the standard that the legislature called out? No, and in fact, the Junior Achievement was not harmed by this.
And you seem to focus on that the notion of harm, but harm isn't just economic. I mean, harm has to do with the company's, you know, reputation in the community and how it treats people, how it deals with itself. I mean, it almost seems like your argument gets down to, well, because the appellant's acts enhanced the trust and secured the trust's asset, and the district court agreed. But you almost seem to be making an ends justifies the means sort of argument. I mean, is that what this is about, or am I wrong about that?
No, I don't think it's an ends justify the means. What I think is that when Junior Achievement articulated, testified about this, and the court made findings about it, you have to remember all of the findings that the court made and whether they can amount to harm to the trust. And these findings included, there were two phone calls that were offensive, and based on those two phone calls, Mr. Lipschultz was effectively removed. At finding of fact 212, and I refer you also to 213 and 215, but 212, after the first call, a large $1.2 million award was made. It had no restrictions, limitations, or conditions, so there was no repercussion or revenge or anything like that. Junior Achievement had no concerns, in fact, regarding any future funding of the trust. So there were no concerns at that point.
But hadn't there been a substantial delay? That's also part of finding 212.
There had been a substantial delay, that's true, but one that did not affect Junior Achievement. There was no specific testimony on that point. Layoffs had previously occurred, true, unrelated, but there was no specific impact and no funding that was at risk. As it relates to the second call that occurred, again, Ms. Juck from Junior Achievement testified that their organization had reached a conclusion at the end of August to not return any grant money. No money was going to be returned. There was no intention of giving it back. Then, when Jean Crane got involved 2 weeks ago, and you can see that in the findings, or 2 weeks before the money ultimately was given back, all of that changed. And so it changed because of that, not because of something that Mr. Lipschultz had done. And if you look at finding of fact 213, at no time did Brian Lipschultz ever threaten Junior Achievement or ask for the $1.2 million back. No discussion of any funding being at risk. No mention of a quid pro quo. No ask that Mr. James, who was getting the awards, that the award be revoked. And there was no personal benefit for Mr. Lipschultz either that was ever mentioned. And then you turn to 215, and Sarah Juck herself testified that she did not know of the litigation and the war that was going on. But once she learned of it, she understood why Mr. Lipschultz expressed frustration. Can frustration like this, expressed for the interests of doing good for the trust, be the basis for removal? That is a central issue in this case. And we believe it's an abuse of discretion to start removing trustees in the state of Minnesota because of this type of offense. In fact, what it amounts to is the rewriting of the statute. There's no case that is like this ever decided here. And there are a number in Minnesota, and there are a number of cases that have, in fact, been reversed on a abuse of discretion standard, not just in Minnesota, but in a number of other states. Animosity between beneficiaries and trustees, between grantors and trustees, or grantees and trustees, has been found not to be sufficient, repeatedly found not to be sufficient. Turn to our initial brief at pages 23 and 24. We have a whole list: the Lovett case, the Parr case, the Loyal Sheen case, the Wolosoff case, the White case, from across the country using the Uniform Charitable Trust Act that reversed removals for similar reasons why this removal should be reversed. And in Minnesota, look to the Rosenbrook case and the Hill case. Both of those cases related to quote unquote animosity between a grantee and a trustee, or a beneficiary, I believe, in those cases, and a trustee. The Schultz case speaks about the abuse of discretion standard. Now, it is under a different statutory provision that Schultz was decided, but the concept is the same. Abuse of discretion is the applicable concept, and it was reversed for an abuse of discretion. So, simply determining that we have abuse of discretion, it's a rubber stamp of the district court. I know this court will not do that, but it is a standard that has to be applied that comes from the law, both as legislatively enacted or maybe written into the trust instrument. There's nothing in the trust instrument that says you need to act a certain way. In fact, most of Mr. Lipschultz's comments that are talked about repeatedly toward the end of the judge's opinion were private text communications that would have no impact on the charity at all, the trust at all. And in fact, the communications were with Joe Goulash, who is with KBW, an investment banker. And in some parts of the country, there's nothing that Mr. Lifshultz did that would even frankly be out of the ordinary. May or may not be the case in Minnesota, but it's certain when we start parsing at the appellate level, we need to be concerned about the standard that we are applying.
Let me ask you this. One of the respondent in its brief has suggested that this court make its decision precedential. And I think you're arguing that that there is no law in Minnesota that specifically says that, you know, just poor behavior or aggressive behavior or whatever is enough to constitute a material breach of the trust. What would you suggest a syllabus point be if we were in fact to make this a precedential opinion?
Well, I think that the court should hold tight, strong to the tether of what the legislature enacted. And the legislature and the courts have given meaning to what a serious breach of trust is, and we should follow that meaning. There is no case that they can cite that
Counsel,
would support.
I see you're at your time, but I do. It does seem that you're hinging your argument on the application of B1, but I'm looking at the district court's order, and it appears the district court also found that this conduct satisfied B3, which has to do with removing a trustee for unfitness, unwillingness, or persistent failures. Thus, it serves the best interest of the beneficiaries. Do you make the same arguments with respect to the interpretation of that provision?
Absolutely, Your Honor, if I may respond. B3 talks about the unfitness, unwillingness, or persistent failure of the trustee to administer or manage the trust effectively. To administer or manage the trust effectively. It has to be persistent. It has to be an unfitness or unwillingness. If I may, Mr. Lifshultz was a trustee for nine years prior to this, nearly 10 years. The court itself made findings regarding the good works that occurred under, in great part, his leadership. Repeatedly, for 90-plus pages, the value of the trust increased twofold. It grew as much in 9 years as in the prior 60 years, created a strategic method for grant-making. This is at 59 to 67. Greatly increased the amount of grant making, more than $400 million
Counsel,
given
you,
away.
You are at time, so I would just ask you to conclude your remarks and you can address us again on rebuttal.
Thank you. I just want to make sure that the findings are read in the context of this trustee and whether B3 is met is going to be driven by that. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Next, we'll hear from counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel, Colin Ballew arguing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. There's two main points I'd like to address today. First, appellant was removed on multiple legal grounds, and each of those grounds independently supports removal, making this what should be an easy decision for this court. Second, we're here because of appellant's egregious misconduct, not because he had sharp elbows or is a mean guy. The district court did not abuse its discretion in applying the legal standards or in finding that appellant put his personal interest before the trust interest. The removal of a trustee is reviewed for an abuse of discretion standard. Appellant was removed under Minnesota Statute Section 501C0706B1 and B3. B1 allows for removal for a serious breach of trust. A breach of trust is simply a violation by a trustee of a duty the trustee owes to the beneficiary. And what constitutes a serious breach is within the discretion of the trial court. Now, this can include a single breach that causes harm to the trust or involves flagrant misconduct.
And what do we have here? Do we have any harm to the trust? I don't.
Yes. Sorry, Your Honor.
Tell me what that is here.
To be clear, harm is not required, but we do have it here. So, for example, appellant misused several thousands of dollars of trust assets when self-dealing. I know there's an argument here that it's de minimis.
Well, the amount is de minimis. You'd agree with that.
In relation to the size of the trust corpus, which is $2 billion, I agree. It's de minimis.
And it was not, it, as I understand the district court findings, it was not motivated by ill will. It was a good faith error.
So that is not my reading of the district court's order. I think my reading of the district court's order is that appellant argued that he did not act, that he had good intentions, but that's not what the court found. I don't think the court said one way or the other. What we do have is, the facts are that we have 8 years of self-dealing, several thousands of dollars, and that he used staff time regularly for his own purposes. But that's not the only harm. In addition to that harm, we also
have... Well, and the $1,800, that's just for the years 2017 to 2019. We don't know exactly what that amounted to from 2012 to 2016, correct?
That's exactly correct. And that could be subject of a future petition, either by the other trustees or the Attorney General's office. So in addition to the harm that I just mentioned, we also have harm in the sense that the trust, I believe, as Judge Bjorkman pointed out, economic harm is not the only type of harm. And here we have harm because the trustee, Lipschultz, violated the trust's sole purpose, which is charitable. And he did so to the point that a grantee returned $1.2 million to the trust and severed ties with the trust. Another harm that we have here is reputational harm to the due to appellant's misconduct, of his misconduct towards grantees, his co-trustee, and others. I don't need to repeat all of what he said to others, because it's in our brief. And then the last harm that's just as important is we are now 2 years into litigation for this trust, and $20 million in legal fees. And insurance is covering some, but not all of those fees. And that is a harm to the trust. This is an aggressive sales, or this is an aggressive sales stance that he took. And now the trust is mired in litigation, and there's no end in sight.
Well, but the district court found nothing wrong with the sale, right? I mean.
Yes, we didn't challenge the fact that the sale was made is not something that we took a position on, but the method in which it was made, which we talked about in our brief, disparaging co-trustee, telling outside parties that your co-trustee would be better suited, a panhandler would be better suited to be your co-trustee than your current co-trustee.
And that's the best. That's that. Are these statements you're talking about the texts and communications with Mr. Is it Goulash?
I believe those communications are, yes.
And that was an investment advisor that the trust retained with respect to this sale, correct?
Yes, that the trust hired.
Okay. So it wasn't like talking to members of the public more broadly?
Not more broadly, no. So an important point, though, of what counsel left out in terms of a serious breach of trust is a serious breach of trust can be a single serious breach, but it can also be a series of breaches that alone would not justify removal and maybe not be a serious breach of trust, but when combined, it does equal a serious breach of trust. And that's really what the court hung its hat on here in the last four or five pages of its order. It specifically says that this is a series of many breaches over 8 years that require removal in this case. And the court didn't stop there. The court also found removal justified, as Judge Larson pointed out, under 07-06-B3 for unfitness and persistent failures. And those two statutory grounds don't require any breach at all for removal to be justified. So each of these legal grounds, appellant's individual serious breaches, appellant's collective breaches, his unfitness, and his persistent failure all support removal and provide a basis for this court to affirm.
Mr. Ballew, I'm going to go back to a question that Judge Bjorkman asked Mr. Parker. You requested in your brief that we issue a precedential decision here. What would our syllabus point be under the circumstances?
So here, under these circumstances, I think this court's syllabus point would be lying to regulators, violating the duty of information, are both breaches of trust that, in the court, trial court's discretion, is a removable, is a serious breach of trust that could lead to removal. In addition to that, of course, we would affirm the already standing Minnesota case law that that self-dealing is a serious breach of trust, regardless of how de minimis it is. It's not about the dollar value. In addition to that, threatening grantees and violating the duty of loyalty for your personal gain, all of that is removable conduct.
What's the personal gain here? I struggle a little bit about what was the personal gain other than wanting the trust to be successful and to be able to have its assets situated so that it could make the 5% distribution required by the law.
So the personal gain with respect to the grantees in this case is that there's two separate occasions. In the first instance, appellant tried to use his grant-making power to end the state's investigation of his misconduct. So that was the personal gain at issue. He coerced or attempted to coerce Junior Achievement to go to the governor or the attorney general and complain that the state's investigation of his misconduct was government overreach. Junior Achievement said no, it wasn't going to do that, and appellant made it clear to Junior Achievement that it was not allowed to apply for a grant at that time. And I understand that they had already cut 40% of their staff due to the pandemic, but they were on a schedule in which they were routinely renewed grants with the trust. They were a long-standing grantee, and they missed nearly a full fiscal year of funding due to appellant's misconduct and nothing else. Now, there's a second breach of trust where there was personal gain involved, involving Junior Achievement. And that was when he told, or when he wanted Junior Achievement to refrain from honoring a Bremer Financial Corporation executive. And the reason he wanted to do that, he wanted it to not honor that executive, is because he thought it would be bad for him in litigation. As the court's order states, He told Junior Achievement that it was a catastrophic situation for him because it was happening just a couple of weeks before trial. And he told Junior Achievement at that time that its decision to honor the executive would damage the relationship going forward between the trust and Junior Achievement. Now, the district court found that this was a threat against future grants, or abusive treatment of a grantee unrelated to any charitable purpose of the trust. That's straight from the order at conclusion 89. And the misconduct was so flagrant that they returned $1.2 million on a 30-1 board vote. This wasn't a close call. So if we take a step back for a second, we think about the context of this. We have a trust whose sole purpose is charitable. Yet, appellant's conduct was so bad that it returned $1.2 million, permanently severed ties with the trust. And he frustrated those charitable purposes. There's no question that this...
One of the arguments Mr. Parker advanced is that even if we assume those two were some sort of misconduct, which I don't think Mr. Parker would say we should assume, but let's look at those two things. Those are two isolated situations involving one grantee out of thousands.
Yes.
How do you respond to the argument that it's just, I'm not saying it's de minimis, but how does that become so significant that it warrants removal, given the context of the thousands of other people who have not complained about similar conduct?
Thank you, Judge Bjorkman. So the statute only requires one serious breach of trust. We have two just in the dealings with Junior Achievement. It also came out at trial that that appellant engaged in similar conduct to this with other grantees, and it's in the judge's order that this is not the first time that he's done similar conduct to this. So it's certainly satisfied that it only takes one instance, and it's because once a trustee has seriously breached trust, forgive the pun, but he can't be trusted anymore. And you don't have to wait for multiple breaches because it's the court's duty to protect the trust. And the court did so in this case by removing appellant. So I want to move on to some of his conduct during the sale of Bremer Financial Corporation stock. Now, counsel has taken a lot of issue with the comment that the court makes that, and this is a quote from the court, "There's no room in the charitable world for animosity and vindictiveness to infiltrate or impact the decision-making of a charitable trustee." And counsel correctly states that that's not the standard for removal, but that's not the standard that the court applied. The court, in paragraph 87, specifically says that it's applying the duty of loyalty standard, which is simply appellant putting his interests ahead of the trust's interests. Now, disparaging a co-trustee, threatening staff, inviting and encouraging litigation, and saying that you have years of reserves of charitable assets to pay for that litigation, a whole host of other comments that I'm not going to repeat in front of this court, none of that is normal conduct for a charitable trustee to engage in. It's not in the best interest of the trust to engage in those comments. And it's not an aggressive attempt to sell the shares of BFC stock. It's a separate thing. There's no abuse of discretion in relying on that misconduct to support a breach of trust. I also want to talk briefly about the duty of information and how it was violated in this case. So the facts are simple. They're fully set forth by the district court in its order. I don't think they need to be rehashed here, but what's important for this court is that the district court found in paragraph 4 of its conclusions that the attorney general has the rights of a qualified beneficiary, and that's laid out in the statute. The district court also found in paragraph 77 of its conclusions that qualified beneficiaries are owed the duty of information by statute. Now, the duty of information requires disclosure of all material facts necessary for qualified beneficiaries to protect their interests. Now, in appellant's reply, he told this court that the district court did not find that he acted deceptively and withheld information from the attorney. Toward the very end of his reply brief. The court actually found that on three separate occasions in its order, finding 85, conclusion 75, and conclusion 76. And the court at one point said, and this is a quote from the court, that it was appellant's deception and secrecy that was troubling in regard to his appointment of a successor. And Minnesota law is clear on this. Supreme Court case from 1948, In re Enger's will, that says that trustees have a fiduciary duty to disclose fully, frankly, and without reservation all facts pertaining to the trust. So I see that my time is up. I'll just end by saying that the district court exercises statutory duty to protect and supervise the trust in this case. This court has multiple avenues to affirm the district court's order. There were no errors of law, and its factual findings are fully supported by the record. This court should affirm on all grounds.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Parker, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal when you get there.
Excuse
I want to respond first by talking about the standard. We have B1 and B3. We've talked about that, and the court cited those. But we do have a definition that the legislature put into the statutes for breach of trust. It's not as if they haven't thought about it and defined it. It is contained, and the court cited it at 501B.41. Subdivision 6 defines breach of trust for one of three things. One, failure to register. That's not at issue here. Two, failure to file annual reports. The opposite was found. It was always consistently found to have filed reports. And third, failure to administer and manage property in accordance with the law or fiduciary obligations. And in order to remove a trustee, there must be a serious breach of trust.
But that can be a series of items.
It can be a series. Now, you heard from the Attorney General's office a number of things and arguments that they made in their brief, arguments that they made at court. But they lost because the findings repeatedly found differently from what the Attorney General's office is attempting to argue here. The removal was based on three things. Not even the failure to unredact the name of the person because Mr. Lipschultz was concerned about his cousin being treated in a way similar to his treatment. Rightly or wrongly, it wasn't, you know, intentionally to deceive. In fact, he testified at trial openly about it under oath. So there was no issue that can put that in the category of a breach of trust. The three things that did apply are the self-dealing, as Judge Larson referred to, but the finding there was that the finding by the judge that we are not appealing, that the Attorney General is not appealing, even though it sounds more like they are appealing a number of the findings of fact and conclusions, they have not appealed, nor have we. The finding by the court was this was a de minimis amount. The finding by the court was that this would not be grounds for removal in and of itself. So it is not the foundation of this removal. That is not being appealed. No one is appealing that. The other two bases for removal, do they meet this definition of breach of trust, is our question. Our number one, these private text messages back and forth. Yes, they were harsh. Were they done out of a lack or duty of loyalty, a breach of duty of loyalty? Far from it. In fact, maybe too much loyalty. Because both Mr. Lipschultz's father, who was a trustee for 51 years, and his grandfather before that for another number of years, his family has been a part of this trust for over 60 years. He cares deeply about it, more deeply, arguably, than anyone. And that may have caused, you know, some of the conduct that was engaged in here. But does it amount to a breach of trust and removal? Is that the precedent that the state of Minnesota wants to have on the books, ignoring what the legislature has done or what's in the trust instrument? Nothing the AGO can point to that's in the trust instrument that supports this removal. And then the third thing is the junior achievement issue. And yes, he was trying to garner support for the trust. And yes, the discussions may have been more harsh and aggressive than we like. Or if he had it to do over again, he might have done it differently. But it is one grantee, and it is one grantee who was fully covered with $1.2 million. And they would never have returned the $1.2 million, we know that, had they not had the backup from the bank. They had their $1.2 million in any event, because it was a forgivable loan that the bank promised to give them. Within 24 hours of talking to Gene Crane, the Junior Achievement Board met and reversed their position Why? Because they were fully covered. Not because Mr. Lipschultz had done something additional or came in and engaged in misconduct. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.